You're listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas.
Welcome back to our second episode of The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas in our fifth season. And this year, what else would you expect but another incredible guest? Today, we're heading to Belgrade, Serbia, via USA, more importantly, down under. That's right, people. All the way from Melbourne, Australia, one of the most versatile and explosive players I've ever seen come through the EuroLeague. And I even got to commentate on his first European game. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Dante Exum. Dante, how you doing, my man? Welcome to The Crossover.
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing a little bit better than you this morning, I guess, but we won't get into that. Hey, look. I was up in Barcelona last year, and I was called up there to go commentate the game. I was doing color for the El Clasico game. And all of a sudden, I get there, and I'm trying to go through my notes and everything else, and I see this new name pop up out of nowhere, like Dante Exum. And I'm like, Australia? I start doing a little bit of research on you. I'm like, yeah, whatever. I'm like, this guy, I mean, this is a classic go. He just got off the plane. I think he literally got off the plane like a day or two beforehand, right? Uh-huh. And so I told my commentator, Andy West, I'm like, hey, I said, let's not expect much out of his Exum character tonight, because I said, he just showed up from Australia. This is a classic go. He's probably never seen anything like this before. And dude, you got 13 minutes in that game.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing. I didn't expect much from myself that game either. As you said, like, I was straight off the plane. I was thrown into, you know, practice after practice, and it was a whirlwind, I'll tell you that. I came straight over, and that was the plan. I think I left maybe Tuesday, and the plan was to, you know, play the Clasico on Friday, and it was a whirlwind. As soon as I landed, I was in MRIs, medical, straight to practice, like everything you could think of. And then on top of that, I wasn't sleeping because of the time difference. And it was tough. I was holed up in my hotel room, just blackout curtains, and just trying to get as much sleep during the day.
You came from the States, right? Was that from the States, yeah, or did you come from Australia? Did they tell you it's going to be Madrid-Barcelona? Did they tell you it's Clasico, or just tell you that, you know, we got a game on Thursday? Or on Friday, I think the game was.
No, they. I mean, you know how it is over here in Europe in the rivalry. So they were. That was the plan. That was the plan to put me in, and I was ready for it. I wanted to. I said to my agent, I was like, let's try and do it before, you know, for the Real Madrid game. I think that would be a good introduction into Europe and kind of what it's about. And I tell you, it was more than I expected. It was crazy. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, that's what everybody says, man. It's just a different atmosphere between, you know, all the, like you said, the rivalries. Right now, you guys, Partizan and Savena Vesda, you got Barcelona, Madrid, Panathinaikos. It's crazy. It's just a different feel from America, but let's get back to where we started now from. Your early life, all right? Your early life. You're only 27. You've been around for quite a while because you started out so young. But your dad played basketball too in North Carolina with Michael Jordan, from what I understand.
Correct. Yeah, he had a good career. He obviously played at the University of North Carolina before getting drafted, but getting injured also. I think he then went over to Sweden for a year, which he was. I actually talked to one of my teammates who was from Sweden, and he said he was somewhere up north where it was freezing cold, and he doesn't know how he survived there. And then had an opportunity to go to Australia. Didn't know anything about Australia, and went with my mom. And ever since then, they loved it, stayed, and you know, had me, my brother, and my sister, and you know, that's how I grew up in Australia.
But both your parents are actually American, though, right?
Yes. Both of them are from North Carolina.
From North Carolina. The weather's not that bad in North Carolina. But, I mean, going up to the south of Sweden in the cold weather, I mean, that's always a big change.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they definitely said some stories about that, where you just couldn't leave your room. And it was a small town. And I don't even remember the name, but they were like, yeah, it was freezing. And they were like, they couldn't do that. So when they heard about Australia and the warm weather down there, so
yeah, once you get down to Australia, you find that weather. That's where you find a home.
Exactly.
Your sister, she's a twin sister, right?
Correct, yep.
What's that like? Because I read somewhere where she said something, she calls you her womb mate.
Yeah, no, it was good. It was, you know, obviously growing up, I had an older brother and a twin sister. So I was kind of that middle child that was, you know, really good friends with both of them. But with my sister, she actually did gymnastics growing up. So we... we're quite, you know, we weren't competitive in that aspect, but, you know, we always had the dream of, you know, representing Australia first. And it was kind of a little competition between us. And, I actually got to represent Australia first and, but no, it was it's just a friendly competition between us.
I hope it's a friendly competition, brother. But I like the fact that you called yourself the middle child when, I mean, really you're not the middle child. What, there was like 14 minutes between the two of you?
Yeah. Yeah. It was something like that. I think it was like 16 or something, but yeah, no, she's minutes. Definitely my younger sister. She's my younger sister. And I let her know. So
you let her know that. I love it. So your dad played with the Nuggets, and then from there he went overseas. But then he went to play in Australia. That's how he got to Australia, right? To also play?
Yeah, yeah.
And he seems like, from everything I was reading about you, he seems like an integral part of your of where you are today, so to speak. You know, you read about these parents all the time that are a little bit over, like, you know, they want their kids to be like a professional athlete, and they push them. But it seems like he was between a mentor and kind of like a guide for you more than he was someone that was pushing you athletically. Is that the way it was?
Yeah, no, I think that's perfect. Just, I think growing up, my dad, you know, he always wanted me to do what, I mean, both my parents wanted me to do what I wanted to do. I think I was the child. I mean, my brother, he always loved basketball, always wanted to do basketball, but I was trying to do every sport possible. I went through a golf stage. I went through trying to do skateboarding. And then I think the real one was like even Australian football. I wanted to play. I played at school, and then I wanted to play like in a local like footy club. And I asked my dad, and he was like, hey, like, you know, you can, like, just, do you want that or basketball? Like, I can't be running around doing basketball, and I can't trying to take you to footy training as well. So, there was a couple times where definitely with that and track and field as well, I wanted to do track and field, and he made me make decisions. And I always fell back into basketball. I always loved it. I always knew it was what I wanted to do. But, you know, obviously growing up, I loved those other sports and wanted to try them. But I think, you know, once it came to it and having to make that decision, it was always basketball for me.
Talk to me about Australian rules football. How long did you play? And I mean, I'm a big NFL fan, so I mean, I love what we call the real football. Forget the soccer, forget the World Cup, forget Australian rules, forget rugby. We call it the real football, but Australian rules football is pretty badass, man. I love watching it.
Yeah, no, it's a great sport. I think I played all growing up and, you know, in school, and I loved it. I could kick the ball, you know, really straight, but I could kick it far and run and tackle. So I think that was, you know, kind of what made me love the sport. And I think, you know, it was just with all your friends, and, you know, there was those gritty games where you were out in the mud and, you know, throwing people in mud. It was just a fun sport, and a different kind of side of basketball where you're always kind of indoors. And, you know, I loved it for that aspect.
When I watch you play, you have a physical aspect about you, a physicality, other than the fact that you're an extremely finesse player, but you're almost like a Dwayne Wade in a way that's not afraid of contact, that's falling on the floor all the time, that's throwing your body around. Does that come from Australian rules football? Is that kind of like where your pedigree came from, your attitude on the basketball court?
I wouldn't say so. I think the falling, I think I've just kind of gotten to a state where I've learned how to fall. I always tell people that, and they don't quite understand it, but in my mind, it's perfect of kind of, you know, I think instead of landing, you know, there's so many feet, you know, I can land on someone's foot and just roll my ankle, anything like that. And I've kind of learned how to, you know, kind of fall and, you know, protect my body that way. I've got a lot of bruises on my elbows and stuff, but over the years, they've kind of hardened up. So, but yeah, no, I think that's just kind of how I've just developed my game and learning just to kind of avoid those type of injuries and kind of sacrifice my body a little bit, but doing it in a kind of a safer way.
You might be the first person I've ever talked to that's actually said to me that they've taught themselves how to fall. Wait till you're my age. You do everything you can to stay off the ground, man, because it takes too long to get back up again.
I went through probably 2 or 3 years of, you know, doing individuals where it was like, all right, we're doing layups and we're not falling, or we're doing layups and we're not going out of bounds. So, you know, I think there's an aspect where I can do that. But I think when I'm going so fast and just getting to the basket, it's just, sometimes you need to, you know, fall or get out of bounds. So
talk to me about the Australian Institute of Sport, which is, I mean, we'll, from now on, we'll call it AIS for anybody who doesn't know. But this is, explain to me a little bit about this facility. It sounds amazing to me.
Yeah, so, I think I was 15 when I got offered a scholarship, and that was kind of the time in my life where it was like, all right, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I want to do. And because, you know, before that, it was just, you know, playing my local comp, and we called it like rep basketball on Friday nights where you play for a club. And that was kind of the extent of my basketball. And when I moved to Canberra for the AIS, it was kind of like, okay, this is going to be an everyday thing. We were doing weights in the morning, shooting after weights, then going to school and then practice after. So it was kind of a, you know, I had to really say to myself, this is what I want to do. So it was 15, kind of young to go there, but, you know, I think I was ready, you know, mentally as well. But I loved the experience. I think it was the, one of the best things for me. It's where I was able to, you know, kind of take my game to the next step. The only problem, I feel like we didn't play games. We kind of, we would travel and play in like tournaments and stuff. But yeah, it was just a great place where I was able to shoot when I want to. You know, we were on a campus, so I could walk over to the gym and shoot whenever. And, you know, getting professional, like, weightlifting. It was the first time I really lifted weights as well.
The scholarship was a basketball scholarship, I'm assuming, right? Just strictly mm-hmm. basketball. Because the facility actually has, like 25, 26 different sports that they work with. So you were there strictly for basketball, 100%.
Yeah, yeah. So the way it works, it's kind of like Australia's, you know, they call it the Center of Excellence now for basketball. But it's like... the Olympic Training Center. So right. Depending on the different types of sports, like basketball is always focused on the juniors, so they bring in juniors. Swimming has kind of those next up-and-coming Olympians. But the whole program of the AIS is to develop the next Olympians to represent Australia. You know, when you kind of get that honor of going there, you know, that's, you know, you have to take it seriously, and that's the next step. And the whole point is to win medals for Australia.
There's a couple things that really interested me about the mentality of the people that were in IIS, and that's just because I've researched it and read about it because of this interview. But it's almost like, did you have that NBA dream at this time, or were you just going there because you wanted to win medals for Australia? You understand what I'm saying? Like, most of us are young kids. It's like, I want to play in the NBA. But it seems like there was more of a mentality towards representing your country.
Yeah, no, I think it goes hand in hand. You know, I think as a competitor, you want to compete at the highest level. So the NBA was, you know, obviously the goal. But, you know, the mindset of going there is to represent my country. And that was something I've always done and want to continue to do. So, but yeah.
What was the moment there during that time? How much time did you spend there?
I was there about three and a half years.
3.5 years. So it's almost like going to a university, because you guys are schooled also. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's essentially getting a scholarship to a university in the States.
Yeah, yeah. So the way it worked, we kind of really focused on, you know, basketball, but we did go to normal, like, high school. It was kind of weird, too, because we were just in classes. So it was not like a normal kind of high school. So if class started at 12 for me, I had to go to school just at 12. So we kind of worked our schedules and picked classes around where we could, you know, shoot and practice in the morning and then go to school, get that out of the way and then go back and practice again.
I love the way you say get that school part out of the way.
Oh no, I was a great student. You can ask anyone.
No, I read that you're a great student, but it doesn't matter if you're a good student or a bad student. You just want to get that school part out of the way and start hooping again. When was the moment that you were like, damn, I think I could do this. I think I'm going to be able to make it. Was it people talking? I know you went to the Nike Hoop Summit and you played against the U.S. team. But what was that moment where you're like, all right, this is going to be a career for me?
I think, kind of growing up, I was always in state teams. We always, you have New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland. So we always played these state program competitions, and I was kind of always excelling at that. So I knew, and then obviously getting to go to the AIS early, I was kind of on that path to be, good or make this kind of what I wanted to do. But it wasn't until I think when I went to under 17s world championship in Lithuania, where I kind of did it on a world stage, and I was, all-star five and going against, the best kids in the world, and able to, do that. We finished second behind the US. So I think kind of when I was there, and it was like, all right, this is kind of, I'm going against the best kids. I can compete. I'm still doing good. I think that was the time where it kind of clicked, like, okay, this is what I can do. And then to follow up with it, it was under 19s when I was bottom age. So it was kids a year older than me. And I did the same thing, and I was, still all-star five, and, we finished fourth. We should have finished third. We should have been in the gold medal game, but so I think that was kind of when it clicked for me. And my dream was actually, honestly, to always go to college. I really wanted to go to college. I was one of the guys I was watching every highlight video of everyone in my class. Looking at they had the ESPN rankings, which I was like never on because, I was a kid from Australia, no one ever heard of. So, it wasn't like today where, you get a lot of exposure, being in Australia. I even see now, going on Instagram, there's more pages of, kids in Australia, their highlights and getting that exposure, but there wasn't a lot of that. So I had to kind of do that, going to these tournaments and going overseas to get that. But yeah, I wanted to go to college, and it wasn't until the under 19s worlds where, I did well, and then they had me on a draft board, and you're on a draft board, you're going to draft. I'm like, I can't go on the draft. Like, I got to go to college. Like, I got to do one and done. Like, that was the goal. Like, I had that mentality. But, then agents started reaching out, and it was just like, no. Like, you're international. You just have to be 19 in the draft year. So that kind of changed the perspective of everything, and, sped up this timeline of what, I wanted to do. And then when that came around, it was just like, well, you know what? College was always just a stepping stone to get to the real goal of the NBA. Because I mean, obviously my dad went to UNC. So, I watched them growing up, and, they're always successful. And, it was always a dream to, go there or at least go to a college and just kind of get that experience. But, when the NBA comes knocking, you're just like, yep, let me go.
I always wondered about that, if you wanted to do the college thing, because I know you had a bunch of offers and the one and done. I'm glad you answered that question for me. But how did you get, was it your dad and connections that he had through the basketball world in the States that kind of got your name out? Because when I was reading an article about you, some reporters in the Bleacher Report came out to visit you for a few days or I don't know, a weekend.
Yeah.
And their biggest thing in their article that I read was nobody knew who the hell you were in Australia. Just kind of like, you were a nobody. You weren't a nobody. You were somebody that was coming up the ranks, but you weren't as well known in Australia as you were in the American market, let's say.
Yeah, yeah. And it was obviously hard. Like, as I said, I was, watching those draft boards and watching some of the guys I played on the USA team, and I felt like I was doing really well against them, and and seeing them like up top 10, and my name not even on there, it's hard. But yeah, you know, I had Bleacher Report come out and, you know, follow me around for a week during my school's national tournament, which was cool. You know, got me a lot of exposure. Yeah, no, it was definitely hard to kind of, you know, get that. You know, my dad was, you know, sending tapes over, and, you know, kind of the only real offers and stuff I was getting was from any university that had college connections to Australia, because obviously Australians right. knew about me, so they were trying to get me over. So, you know, obviously St. Mary's at the time, Boise State had a, you know, real deep connection with Australia. So, you know, those were the schools that were, you know, really high on my radar.
There's always a question I love to ask people, especially in this, it works out better in your situation because you had no college experience, because you had no USA experience, so to speak. Did you just look at this, everybody telling you that the next step in the NBA, like in the back of your head somewhere, I mean, we're athletes. Well, I mean, I'm an ex-athlete, but we still have that athlete mentality and we think we could do anything. But sometimes like someone in the back of your head creeps in that doubt, man, where you start to like, man, this might be moving too quick for me. Was there that moment where you're just like, man, I'm not sure if I'm ready?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. You know, I think the last game before that I played before I went into the draft and played NBA was a high school game in Australia.
Exactly.
So, you know, I was playing the point guard, but I was taller than our five man. So like it was just a different time. And I always remember the first time I went into, you know, once I got drafted and I went into Utah, like I went into the office with Dennis Lindsay, who was the GM at Utah at the time. And he said, I was watching your game tape of your school's national tournament. And I said, I first thought, don't watch that. Like, because, you know, it's the level of competition was just very, very different. And, but that's all they had to go off. So
what did it feel like being fifth in the draft, fifth overall pick by Utah? I mean, were you pretty much aware that was going to be the deal before they called your name, or were you just like shocked?
Yeah, no. So, I knew they were. It was actually, it's kind of a weird thing because, when I was going through the draft process, I worked out for, I think it was like 2 through 4. And then 6 through 9. So I worked out with pretty much everyone except for Utah. And the reason for that was because the previous year before that, they drafted a point guard, Trey Burke. So I was kind of like, me and my agent talked about it. I was like, yeah, like Utah, they're not going to want to do it or whatever. And it wasn't actually until draft night, I was on the bus heading over to the Barclays Center, and I get a phone call from my agent, and he's just like, hey, like, I think Utah could be a good spot. And I'm like, are they picking me? Cause he was trying to sell me on the idea of Utah right. and everything, but it was, you know, it was something we never talked about. So, I kind of knew at that point, that it was going to happen. And then obviously I got there and I talked to my agent. He's like, yeah, they're going to pick you. And, it was kind of a weird moment. I was, you know, sitting there, you know, you hear the first, you hear the second, you hear the third, and then the fourth, and then it's like, all right, this one's coming up. And then I think they took a break, and I was like, oh no, like just kind of preparing for that moment. What am I gonna do? All right, hands do I shake first? Like, what do I do? All right, when I get on stage, like, don't trip. Like, what kind of handshake am I gonna do with Adam Silver? Like, everything was going through my head. And so I was just trying to, you know, try and play it cool. But obviously, it was just an exciting time. And then after that, just the whirlwind of, you know, everything started.
No disrespect to Utah at all, because I think it's a beautiful city and obviously one of the best franchises organizations in the NBA. But you know, when you get, I don't know who the teams were before or after Utah, but you know, when you got, you know, cities like LA, Miami,
New York. I can tell you right before. Like, fourth was Orlando, sixth was Boston, and then seventh was Lakers. So I can tell you that. But yeah, no, it was weird, and it was a shock because, you know, I didn't know anything about Utah. It was, you know, just something we never looked at. Right. But obviously, you know, I get there and, you know, you just learn more and more about the city and kind of what they're about, and, you know, I wouldn't change it for anything.
How was that first winter though?
You know what? It wasn't bad. I think Utah winters get a kind of a bad rap, but
there's a lot of snow.
Yeah, but they clean it up really well, and I feel like the sun comes out. But I went to Cleveland, and no, I have a Utah winter any time of the year compared to a Cleveland winter.
Hey, look, I'm from upstate New York, which is you, in Cleveland. Yeah. You were on Lake Erie. In upstate New York, I was on Lake Ontario, and I know exactly. It's the windy cities, windy city Chicago. But man, there's wind coming off of that water, and you get like 10-foot snow piles blowing around.
In Cleveland, I stayed right next to the Brown Stadium on the lake. And yeah, that wind hits you, and it's just a different type of cold. And there was like two or three snowstorms while I was there, and it was like days where we're like, maybe we can't get to practice. Like, it was that type.
Yeah, we used to call it, when I was up in Niagara University in the fall, we used to call it the hawk. It was so cold. It was like a hawk just like biting down on you, and it's that cold you can't get rid of all day long. Once even if you're inside in the warm weather, it's still like in you.
Yeah. Yeah, see, I never felt that in Utah. I never felt that.
No, Utah's a lot calmer, and it's just a different type of winter. It's like, kind of like Colorado. It's a lot of snow, but it's not. You don't have that lake breeze effect coming off at you.
Yeah,
it's kind of run through your NBA career real quick. I mean, you've played in about 250 games, but man. And this is something I always talk to people about because, you know, it happened to me. It didn't happen to me injury-wise, but it happened to me that I was just, you know, my dream at one point was to get to the NBA. I got to the NBA, then I got released right before that cutoff date. And then they told me to hang around, and, you know, you learn kind of a business that it is. And in your case, you've been just beat up with injuries throughout the 4 or 5 years you were there. You have that dream when you're at IIS to go to NBA, whatever, and you never really, that's never really part of your dream. You know what I mean? The bad parts of it. Tell me what it's like for a kid that's, I mean, you went relatively young, obviously, to the NBA to go through these injuries. First, I think it was your knee, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Yeah. ACL.
I mean, you played 82 games. You started like 41 of them that first season. To go down with that, what goes through your mind? What goes, I mean, because we're strong as athletes. We have a lot of confidence. We have a lot of overconfidence. But we're also weak at times when bad things happen, because we're not used to having bad things happen. What's going through your head at this time, your first injury?
Yeah, that was definitely a tough time. I think as you said, like my first year, I played all 82. And I think for me, you know, that first year was obviously, you know, my last games were playing high school basketball. And so it was finding my feeling, kind of seeing where I fit in and kind of like a system and the NBA and how the games played. So just trying to kind of, you know, find my feet through that. And then I felt like I had a really good summer. And then I went over and I played national team, and it was the last game before we were heading home, and we were in Slovenia. And I unfortunately did a normal move, a normal stop that I've done 1,000 times in my life before. And just that time my knee decided to give out. And so I'm stuck over in Slovenia, you know, with a torn ACL, and, you know, just the emotions of everything going through my head of, you know, kind of how to, you know, what's this look like? How's this going to be? Like, how long am I out? Like, everything's just running through my head. And I flew straight back to Salt Lake. And then it was just kind of, I had to train myself to snap out of that kind of feeling sorry for myself. I think that was the most important thing. Because, you know, you want to do great. You want to be on the court. That's the goal. And I felt like I had a really good summer where I was going to have a good season. And then to know that, and then talking to the doctors and everything, it's like, yeah, you're going to be out for the whole season. You know, that's tough. So for me, it was just, okay, now I had to go full head steam and, you know, kind of the rehab. And that's what I did. And then obviously there was days where I didn't want to do it, where, you know, I wanted to, you know, just go into a cocoon, a bubble, and just, you know, stay in bed for a week and just be like, I can't deal with this. But it was always that kind of, you know, that drive that, okay, next year, you know, this is, you know, it's going to be better. I'm going to be playing. And so that was what kind of drove me. And then the hardest thing that people don't actually realize is that you're around it the whole time. So I didn't leave Salt Lake. I was in Salt Lake. So I was at every home game. I was at every practice and then doing my rehab after. So my days were twice as long as, you know, everyone else, you know, because the coach still wanted me to, you know, kind of be involved in, you know, in film sessions learning. So that was the hardest thing, because there was games and days where I just didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be around. I looking back at it now, I wish I would have said, hey, I need a mental day. Like, let me just go do my rehab, but I don't want to come in and do like watch practice or anything. Because I feel like that's important.
You're 19 or 20, right, at this time?
Yeah, 20, yeah.
Nobody was there with you. You were in Utah alone?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody realizes how hard that is, man. The physical aspect's kind of easy for an athlete because you know what you have to do. You have people telling you what you have to do to get back, but nobody can actually get into your mind and help you, like you said, and say, hey, look at, you know, just give me a week off. I'll be at rehab every day, but I just don't want to be around a team. I just feel like I need to kind of like disconnect myself from it. It's so hard for a 19-year-old to come up or a 20-year-old come up and tell the Utah Jazz that you just want to disconnect from the team for a little bit. You're playing with fire.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I was able to get through it. But I mean, the medical staff, you know, were great with me. They understood definitely that there were some days like I would walk into the weight room and he could just see it in my face that I didn't have it, or today just wasn't the day. It wasn't my day. So, you know, we kind of navigated through it like that. But yeah, you could definitely tell. And I always say it, and I use that my experience to help, you know, people on my team now, like that are going through things, to, you know, just talk to them. And, you know, it's, hey, just knock it out for an hour. Do it hard for an hour and then you're done for the rest of the day, like type stuff. So.
And then once you get yourself back from the knee injury, the shoulder happens.
Yeah.
I'm not laughing like a joke. It's crazy. It's
that one was, I think, the hardest one for me to understand. Because I think I went into the next season, you know, we had a better team. So I was kind of in and out of the rotation, but I was still trying to find myself. I was still trying to learn how to trust my knee and trust, you know, because, you know, as you know, I say, I go fast and I fall and I do all this, but there's this kind of mental roadblock that you have to get over, you know, going through an injury like that, not using your knee for 6 months. I found it hard. And then I was battling a lot of tendonitis in the knee. I think that year happened. And then I had a really good summer league and I was like, yes, okay, this is the year. Like, I'm a year out from ACL injury and I'm ready. And it was a preseason game and I went up for a layup and someone jumped on my back and I did everything I can to protect myself. But, I fell kind of, you know, with my hands trying to protect myself and my shoulder, popped out. Like, I'm not popped out. It, separated. And I can remember, like, it makes me, I get choked up, like even thinking about it. And you could just see, I remember the faces of everybody in like our, in the back, like, cause the game was still going on. Like, I had the GM, all the medical guys in there. And you know, you could see, cause they seen how hard I'd worked and it was just something so silly and stupid in a preseason game, that, you know, I separated my shoulder and I was like, I at first thought it was I dislocated my shoulder. So I was like, okay, you know what? They just pop it back into place and, right. You know, I might not have to get surgery. I could just, you know, rehab it for a little bit. And then, you know, it might be something that, you know, keeps popping out, but I can kind of deal with it. That was my first initial thought. So I kind of was like, hyped myself up. Like, so I wasn't like in that kind of emotional state yet. I was kind of like mad, but I was kind of like, all right, we can deal with this. So I said I remember I go to the trainer, I was like, all right, let's pop it back in. Like, I'm ready. Like, give me a towel, whatever, I'll bite it. Like, let's pop this back out. And he said, no, like, that's separated. You're going to have to, you know, it's not, it can't be popped back in place. And then that's when I just lost it. I was like, I remember I threw my phone. At that point I was done. Cause I didn't know the timeline. I didn't know anything. And then it was kind of, after that, it was like, all right, now we're on this rat race trying to figure out what's the best, because, with these injuries, you can not have surgery, or you can have surgery. I think Chris Paul has a separated shoulder, but he doesn't have surgery. But mine was so high that we didn't know. I could do 2 months of rehab and it doesn't feel right, and then I have to get surgery. So we elected to just get surgery. Cause it's tough. Like, I was like, I literally said to them, I was like, I don't know how I would be if I would do 2 months of rehab only right. to be like, this doesn't feel right, or it's not right, and have to then get surgery. And then it starts again. And then something that was, you know, 6 months turns into 8-9 months. So that was, I think, honestly, the toughest one for me. Cause it was a stupid play, and it was just something, you know, even the doctors were saying, yeah, this doesn't happen in basketball. It's just not a basketball injury.
Yeah. It is a strange injury for basketball. You know, usually with, you know, you talk about legs or knees or, you know, but that's a strange injury. But then you come back again and then you get the ankle and you tear your patella tendon in your right knee. Was that part of the tendonitis thing that was just an ongoing kind of chronic thing?
It was hard. Yeah. I came back and I was playing really well at this point. And then I stepped on someone's foot and my ankle. So this kind of leads into how I did the patella, but the ankle, I just couldn't get it right. And it's always hard because, you know, now I'm starting to build this, always injured. So, you know, for me, it was like, I was doing everything I could to get back, but my ankle just didn't feel right. And I had bone bruising. That was the problem. So running on my ankle and doing that was just, it wasn't feeling right. And, it was, I think 2 months I was out for that. And every week in the NBA, they just do, reevaluate in 2 weeks. So every time it was like reevaluate, oh, he's going to be out another 2 weeks. And, you know, I was like, oh, like we, everyone's just thinking this is an ankle sprain. So I'm like, all right, we need to get this back. And, the biggest thing for me is I really wanted to get back in the rotation because playoffs were coming soon. So I was like, all right, you know, it was like a month towards playoffs and I was feeling decent. I wasn't 100%, but I was feeling good. And I went out the first game and went to stop and my patella tendon just tore. And that I think that was the first time I realized, you know what? Okay. I can't rush injuries because I think I was favoring the other leg and it put too much pressure on that leg. And then just decided to go at that point. So yeah.
the biggest problem, again, I go back to the mental aspect, but it goes back to you have to be thinking that shit, all of a sudden now I'm getting a reputation as being injury prone. They look at me in a different light now. And I mean, was there a moment where you were like, man, the hell with this? It's not worth it. I'm going at this nonstop. I want it so bad, but I keep getting hurt. But was there that moment of giving up maybe or thinking about?
No, I wouldn't say for me, like, you know, this was always something I wanted and something, you know, I was always going to work at. So I never was at the point where, I wanted to give up or I was like, this isn't worth it. You know, obviously it was hard and everything, but it was always about getting back on the court. It was always about, you know, playing that next game and, thinking about that. And that's what I think kept motivating me to, you know, keep going to rehab, keep going in every day, keep trying to learn and do all that so I can just get on that court and just, you know, play again. You know, one of the quotes that everyone always says is, you know, treat every game like your last game. And, right. You know, it's something everyone kind of, you know, it's like, oh, like, yeah, you know, but for me, it's like at that point, it was a real thing. It was like, You know what? I never know when it's going to be taken away from me. And I think you kind of always take things for granted when, you're just playing and going through it, or, we're playing, four games in 7 nights, and that fourth game, you're just like, man, like, I just don't want to play tonight. And it's always for me, it's like, snap back. All right, cool. You know what? Remember when I was out for, a year with my ACL? Like, all right, we can get through this. Thank you. So I think that's always kind of helped me kind of go forward with it.
But I mean, you also have to start thinking about, man, 4 games in 7 nights, man. My body's not where I need it to be, because I haven't had time to do my personal stuff. And so that's got to get going through your mind too. I mean, if you haven't been injured before, that doesn't go through your mind. But if you're going through what you've been through, that's got to be like, man, I'm tired. I don't know if I should be playing here tonight, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I always try to stay out of that mindset, and, it's always the, the superstitious stuff, like, oh, I shouldn't have done this, shouldn't have done that, or I'm not supposed to drive, so if I did that, I wouldn't have got injured. But I learned kind of never to be like that, and just kind of always just go out and play, but take care of the stuff so I know that when I do go out and play, that I've done everything before to prepare, that I'm in the right state, to play. So whether that's doing my, kind of, we call it corrective stuff for my knees, ankles, anything, just to make sure I'm ready.
That's the funny part is you try not to think about it. That's like trying not to think that you're going to be up all night while you're trying to fall asleep. It's like you're still thinking about it regardless. Yeah. You can mentally tell yourself not to think about it, but it's always there. Let's get on to some happier times. I had a short NBA career, man. You played 250 games. That's about 241 more than I played, I think. But you had a nice little stint there, and then you came to Europe on a 3-month contract to Barcelona. We already talked about your first game being against Real Madrid. It was some advice from Joe Ingles and Nathan Jouai, right? That kind of like pushed you over to say, this is what I want to do now. And I got to think mentally, you're thinking like, I need to go somewhere again and show that I could play this game without being hurt.
Yeah, I think the decision of, kind of coming over to Europe, I think that first jump over is the hardest, because you always want to be in the NBA and you want that dream, because that's always been my dream. But, with all the injuries and everything, I think the most important thing for me was playing. Showing the health and showing that I can, stay healthy and be on the floor. So I think, coming over to Europe, gave me that opportunity, and, it was less games a week. And even though I think with everything that happened with COVID, we actually had our month of March was worse than an NBA schedule with the travel and everything. So, I get through that fine. And, But coming over here was just, prove I can stay healthy. I can still compete. I've still got that competitive factor about me.
How difficult is it? Because this is actually kind of the first time you've done this. How difficult is it to walk into a team like Barcelona? I think if I remember right, it was December 20th or December whatever that you showed up and played that first game in El Clásico that we talked about earlier. How difficult is it for a guy like you, because you're a pretty humble kid, you seem to be more of a team player than you are egotistical. I don't know, you're just a good kid. That's the bottom line, and that's what everybody said, everything I've read about. How hard is it for a good kid to come and jump into a team like Barcelona, who's at that point, they're in first place already? They have a team that's pretty well set. Where did you find your comfort zone, or how long did it take you?
Yeah, it was very difficult. Yeah, coming in, you come over and you obviously have all these aspirations that you're going to come over and dominate and do well, but you're coming into a team that's established. They're first in ACB, first in EuroLeague, so obviously something's working in the team. And, for me, I was trying to come in and, obviously play well and, play a part in the team. But, I wasn't trying to disrupt that winning and what they were doing. And, you know, luckily I felt like I was able to do that. I bought into kind of, you know, what they were doing there, and just kind of took my opportunities as they came. You know, it was hard. Yeah. You know, 'cause you want to go over there, you want to score, you want to have the ball, you want to assist, but, you know, yeah, it was definitely tough. And at that point, I was kind of like, I've always played the one, and in that team, I started in the two, but then we had, you know, Abrinas and Kuric, and then it was like, all right, no, let's slot you into the three. So now I'm playing the three and guarding threes and, you know, just trying to kind of navigate that. But I felt like I think it took a bit of time to kind of feel where I fit in. You know, once I kind of got it and understood how I can help, I felt like I did well.
You were pretty much set from what I read. It was 3 months and back to the NBA. That was your goal. What happened?
I think, you know, for me, it was, when I was there and I looked at kind of weighed the options of, okay, if I do go back over, you know, what you said, it's like a 10-day contract or, you know, even then, I actually, as soon as I first got over there, I think it was the time where COVID just hit the NBA like crazy. And so everyone was getting a 10-day contract. And I'm like thinking like, man, like if I had just waited a week or 2 weeks, I could have, you know, had that and had an opportunity. But then I looked at it like, you know what? I would have gone to a team. I would have played a couple games and then it would have been 10-day over. And then I might have gone to another team. And, you know, with all the, you know, the injuries and everything that was happening, I wanted that kind of stability of, you know, playing on a team and, you know, showing I could play a season and stay healthy. So I think kind of as we got to that kind of end date in February, I was like, you know what, like, I want to finish this out. I want to continue and just play the rest of the season out here.
You played for Barcelona. You guys won the King's Cup, the Copa del Rey. And that, I mean, you had just started almost at that point. You've only been with the team for a month and a half or 2 months, I guess. Usually that's in mid-February. And you lost in the finals to a Madrid team without their coach, without their head coach on top of it. Which one do you remember most? which one's still in your mind right now?
Oh, it's definitely the Madrid game. You know, I think we had it. We were up, you know, at halftime by, you know, plus 10. And it was just one of those, you know, things. You always remember the losses over the wins, I think. And, yeah, I mean, EuroLeague was what we wanted. And, like, you know, I remember even going into the Bayern series, you know, we went to game five and everything we were talking about was, hey, this is our season right here. This is our season. So everything was kind of about, you know, EuroLeague and, you know, winning that game. It's like, all right, like, you know, it's two more games and we're champions of Europe. Like that was it. Two more games. And, you know, they were obviously there last year and, you know, missed it by, you know, like a little bit. So they had a taste and they had that feeling of where they wanted to go. So, you know, even just talking to the guys and how much it meant for them to, you know, get back there and, you know, to win it all this year, you know, I wanted it too. And I think that one just hurt the most. And then what made it worse was it's to your rivals. Like, so, yeah, no, that one definitely hurt. And then it was, I mean, it's hard to play that third place game too, but, you know, it's hard.
Hey man, they always yell at me when I do this crossover when I talk to you guys, man. But I've been trying to get rid of that third and fourth place game for about 15 years, man. It's not gonna happen.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, I mean, I don't
say wanna hey, talk, say whatever.
Took any bad on it.
Say whatever you want.
I mean, it's.
they're gonna cut it out anyways.
Yeah, no, it's it's just. I mean, it's just. At that point, it's like we're not even, you know, we don't. I mean, not that I want a medal or anything, but it's just like third place, like for what? Like, so, but that's how we felt. Like it was just that feeling that we had that where it was win it or the season was a bust. And I mean, it wasn't the feeling that we just had. It was, you know, everyone had too.
The thing about it was, and I don't remember the exact numbers right now, because I'm sure I had them at the time because I was doing the Final Four. The exact numbers, I don't have the exact numbers, but it was like, yeah, you guys had won like 9 of the last 10 games against Real Madrid. And it was pretty much, I don't know if you guys bought into that and there was that little bit of relax, but it's, you know, in your mind, you're like, you're confident because you've won 9 of the last 10 or 8 of the last 8 or whatever. Yeah. But there's always that little part in the back of your mind. Like, shit, man, this is our arch rivals. Yeah. We got to lose one sooner or later. It can't be this one.
Yeah, you would trade all those 9 in for this one, just this one. All those ones didn't matter. And yeah, like for me, it was because they lost in the Supercopa, which was that preseason tournament to Madrid. And I think they were up 20 as well. So
between you and I, that Supercopa doesn't mean a damn thing. I don't know why people count it as titles, but it doesn't mean a damn thing.
Yeah. Yeah, but I wasn't even there. So I've only, every time I've been there, it was only beating Madrid. Like we'd only ever beat them. So, and then that one that we wanted the most, the one that, you know, mattered the most, we weren't able to get over the line.
Going from the NBA, come over to EuroLeague, I could ask you what the differences are, but we don't have enough time because there's a million different differences. But when you get into that Final Four weekend, there's nothing like it because you don't feel the pressure as a player because you're used to just going out and playing, but there's so much pressure to have an incredible season all year long. And it comes down to 2 games. I don't know if it's fair or not, but I love the format and the fact.
Yeah, I've kind of gone back and forth of whether I like it or not, because I feel like in terms you kind of always want the best team winning, but I feel like the unique factor of it is that you have to, you know, it's just 2 games. You have to win 2 games. And I mean, you see this with a lot of EuroLeague games. The EuroLeague games come down to the last 5 minutes of the fourth. Like, it doesn't matter what the score is. You know, once it kind of hits there, it's like, all right, cool. You could be up 10, 12. You're like, all right, this game's going to be a close one at the end. Like, it's just that feeling with every EuroLeague game. So it's kind of tough. Like, obviously, I feel like if you're the best team, you want a series, you want a 5-game series, you want a 3-game series, anything. But if you're that team that's kind of the underdog that, you know, hey, we can play, you know, 2 good games and win, like that's kind of what you want. So I think it does kind of add a good kind of component of it. But yeah, it is a tough way to be because, I mean, all these EuroLeague games, definitely at those, like, I mean, I think I saw a stat on kind of the, like, I mean, the FS game before us and Olympiacos went on the buzzer.
Right.
We went close. Like, we could have hit a shot. Like, so there's a it's tough. Like, I don't know.
the crazy thing about this league is if you go on a 2-game losing streak, you can go from third place to 12th place in a matter of, like, a week, you know? And on the other hand, if you win 3 in a row, you can drive yourself up also. But it's like a scoring average, though. You know, it's harder to move up. It's harder to move up the scoring average than it is to move down. You have 2 bad games, and your scoring average goes down like 3 points. But same thing. Every time you look at that stand, it's like, damn, where are we now? And you look like, all right, we're 7-4. Damn, but the 12th place team, is, you know, they're 5-6, only 2 games behind us.
Yeah.
And now you're off to, we'll finish up in Serbia now. You're in Serbia, and I didn't talk about your ex-coach for a reason yet, your Barcelona coach, because I want to talk about your new coach, who was my coach for 3 years also.
Mm-hmm.
You know the whole story about these 2 guys, right? I mean, Sardes played for Zelgo, and it seems as though Sardes took over that Zelgo persona and that way to coach, where the two of them get that cherry red face, and you know,
yeah,
and they probably sweat more than you do You're playing against the Times. First of all, tell me about Sardes. Tell me about what it was like coming over and having him. And he's a point guard, too. So, you know, one of the hardest things for a point guard player to do is to have a point guard coach.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it was, it was tough in that aspect. Like, because, you know, him being a point guard, you know, he kind of wants to, you know, has all these ideas and how, you know, he played the game and, you know, how he wants to play the game. So I think he tries to implement that and do that as much as possible. And yeah, I think, you know, for me, I wasn't playing the point at that time. So I was kind of off the ball. So it was a bit easy for me to navigate and just kind of, you know, play downhill and do all that stuff. But yeah.
That's all you got for me, huh? Coming over and having, because I always look at him and I, like I said, I played with Zelko for 3 years and I see so much of Zelko inside us. You know, I always said it's best to be on the court and screw up with these guys, because when you're on the bench, you're always getting yelled at because of what the guys on the court did.
Oh yeah, that's one of the craziest things. He'll come and like bring the board up, start yelling at you, and just give you this. both of them like give you an evil eye, like, you, and you're just like, coach, that wasn't me. Like, I didn't do that. Like, I'm sitting right here. Like, you, and you just sit there and you're like, hey. Coach, put me in. I won't do that. Like, yeah. But yeah, it's always funny. Like, they kind of just get frustrated. They can't yell at them on the court because it's going, so they just turn and yell at us. Like, right. No, it's always funny. Like, they both do that. They both do that.
That's so funny, man. Every time I see that happen, I coached, you know, like JV varsity kids. I do the same thing to them. Like, somebody screws up on the court. I'm like, I've been telling you guys all season not to do that. You know, it's just you're yelling at people, but. What made you? All right, so I want to go finish off with this NBA. You're at Barcelona with the thoughts of going back to the NBA. You don't go back to the NBA. You have the summer and you sign with Partizan. Three questions in one: what made you not go back to Barcelona? What made you not go to the NBA? And what made you go to Partizan?
So I think going into the summer, I want to go to the NBA. That's the dream, to go back there. But looking at kind of, you know, where I was, and, you know, it always goes back to the injuries and kind of, you know, missing all those games. I want to play. That's the bottom line of everything. And looking at kind of weighing up the options, a lot of the NBA stuff that I was doing was like, yep. Yeah, like, you can come in and, you know, wait for a guy to get injured and, you know, then you'll get your opportunity, or, you know, practice well and then, you know, you can break the rotation. And I feel like I can help a team, and I want to do that. I want to prove that. And I think that was kind of where I was with the NBA stuff, where, you know, I could have gone over there and, you know, you see guys that have been in Europe going over there and, you know, they're not getting those, you know, opportunities like they do in Europe to play a lot. So I think that was kind of the biggest decision for me, where I wanted to kind of keep this momentum of keep playing, keep showing health. And, you know, I have the most fun when I'm on the court. I don't want to be sitting on the bench. I don't want to be, you know, just practice, being a practice guy. So I think I'm 27. I want to play. So I think that was the biggest decision on that. And then, you know, weighing up going back to Barcelona, it was a tough. I felt like I wasn't able to, you know, fully kind of play how I wanted to play and show the potential that I was, that I could do in Europe. So, and then the Partizan option came up, and I think for me, it's just, yeah, I just want to play. I want to be on the court. I want to have that freedom to, you know, I was able to go back into the point guard role and kind of have the freedom to, you know, run a team and, you know, make decisions like that. So I think that was kind of the biggest reason in choosing Partizan over Barcelona.
Obviously, we come up with the fact that you're from Australia. You spent most of your time in your professional career anyways in the NBA. Do you have any idea? Did you have any idea who Partizan was, and and what this club was all about and the history and the nostalgia and everything that has to do with Partizan, KK, Partizan. I mean, they've been called so many different things, but do you have any clue whatsoever? I mean, because we normally, like as Americans, we don't at all. We have no idea.
Yeah. I only had a little bit, and that was only because I'd grown up with a Serbian friend, and he was Partizan. He was a Partizan fan, and I never understood it, and I never, you know, he would always show me. He was like, "Yeah, watch these fans," like, and he would show me Partizan fans, and then actually one of my other friends who's Serbian too, that he got to go on a trip and. They came to Belgrade and actually got to go to a Partizan Red Star Derby, and he told me all about it. I never understood it. But I'd always watch videos on it, so I kind of knew from that standpoint. But even just coming here, like it's different. Like the fans, like I remember we were traveling back, and you know, obviously we just lost to Madrid, and the one thing they said, "Oh, don't worry about that. Just beat Red Star." That's all they care about. Just beat Red Star. Beat Red Star. So, you know, and obviously, like, you know, last night was, you know, disappointing for us. But yeah, like we get them to play them again in EuroLeague in I think a week or so. So, you know, we'll be ready for that game. And it's different, and it's always hard because those games, you know, I've heard so many things about it, and the games can go for 5 hours, can go for four, can go for six, like. You never know. They're removing fans and doing this, and it's just the passion behind it. But it was exciting to be a part of, and you know, we get to play them, you know, at least three more times this year, and you know, hopefully we get those three. I mean, what you said about the, you know, with Madrid and Barcelona. Like, you know, they can win the first one and we can win the rest. Like, as long as we win the ones that matter, so.
You played it, like, obviously, in Panathinaikos. You played it against Olympiacos and their courts. You know, you've been through the European tour, let's say. What's the one game where, other than probably your first game, I would imagine, the Clásico, but what's that other game that where you just kind of looked up and you just kind of like, because I've done this before, you know, when I first came over, I just looked around like, what the hell is... And it just motivates you so much to play, or even if you're home or away, it's motivating. But what was it your first game in Partizan? Was it, you know, watching the Panathinaikos, Olympiacos fans?
Yeah, I honestly think that first EuroLeague game with Partizan, that game, and when they did, they sing a song right before, and that song, like the whole crowd, you look out, and it was just covered in, like, everyone with scarves holding it out. And it was literally goosebumps. It was goosebumps.
I freaking love it.
20,000 people, you know, singing in unison, the passion, like everything. And, you know, it's crazy because a lot of the times, like, people have been telling me, like, oh, like the arena that a Red Star play in, because Partizan played in it last year, they're like, oh, like, playing in there is so much better than Stark Arena. Like, nah. 20,000 Partizan fans in Stark Arena, I'll take that any day over the smaller gym. I think, yeah, it was goosebumps. And even the last game we played against Maccabi, you probably saw a photo where they put up the picture of the dude when they were singing that song. Yeah, that it's just unbelievable. I think when every time those EuroLeague games, that's the moment where I look around and I go, man, this is unbelievable. It's like a movie. Like it is. Right. You can't explain, like, okay, yeah, I'm about to play for these fans that just want us to win. Just want us to win. And I love looking out in the crowd and just seeing there's like three or four of them that they literally don't even watch the game. They're just standing up and they're just chanting. Like they don't watch the game. They don't look. I watch them for like a minute. Like I should be watching the game, but I'm watching them. I'm like looking at them and they don't watch the game. They don't, if a shot happens, they don't care. They're just like ready to, you know, like start the chant and make sure everyone's chanting. And it's unbelievable. I can't explain it. I don't know if you've come to a EuroLeague game here, but it's something I've been,
and as a matter of fact, I'll probably be coming to the one you guys play this year against Real Madrid. So I'm looking forward to I'm looking forward to getting back there. But to me, it's always been amazing. Like how could 20,000 people that showed up at a game separately be so in unison and be able to all of a sudden just out of nowhere just start clapping together and singing the same song? It's always amazed me.
Just in tune, like it's like they don't miss a beat at any point. Like they know what songs, and that's the best thing, because obviously they're singing the songs. They've probably been singing these since they were babies,
right?
And they know it. Like, and even the guys on the bench, like Serbian guys, they're singing the songs too. And it's an amazing thing.
You got guys on your bench from the team singing the songs too.
Yeah. Really? I didn't even know the words, awesome. And I'm sitting there like trying to sing it. Just like, hey, what does that mean? What is that? What are they singing about? You know?
I love it. You're having a really good year right now so far. I mean, the team's up and down, but you guys, it's a new team in EuroLeague, a lot of history. You personally having a good year, averaging about 11, 12 points a game. You mentioned before that you made this change because you didn't feel like you were being maybe used enough in Barcelona, or used the way that you wanted to. You feel that way with Zelko? You feel like with Zelko, I had the best 3 years of my life. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I had the worst 3 years of my life. It was like a marriage, you know? It was the worst 3 years of my life and the best 3 years of my life, because He got so much more out of me as a player and as a person than I ever expected that I had. When Zelko showed up here at Real Madrid when I played, I was at the top of my game. I was known as one of the best, four players in Europe, if not the best. And he just looked at me, he's like, nah, forget that. He's like, you can be better, And I feel like that's what he does with a lot of players, and it seems like that's kind of what's happening with you a little bit. I kind of see like you feel more confident in your role. He's giving you a little bit more freedom, and even though he's hard to deal with sometimes, man, he's not the easiest guy in the world to deal with.
And I think that's the biggest thing about it. I think he's challenging me, and I'm challenging him in a way. But
he loves that too. He loves that a player will challenge him. He likes that because he knows that you're confident and you want to win.
So, and I think that's the thing. I have that, that freedom, but he continues to challenge me to, be able to, take over game knowing, and I'm still learning kind of how to do that. And, when I've got it going, and I think going into that point guard role, he said at the start of the year, I'm going to be the hardest on you. I'm going to challenge you the most. Like, you need to realize when, why we're doing this play or when we should do this play, like just little stuff like that. And I think the biggest thing, with him, he challenges you to, he'll give you the freedom to play, but he wants you to play smart. And right. I think that's the biggest thing about him. It's just like, you can go out there and, do whatever you want, but be smart, play the right way. And, I think that's the best thing that I've liked about him so far. And then just, challenging me to, be out there and be the leader and kind of understand the game and how it's going and, just run it from that standpoint. And I think going and talking about that, obviously you've been around it, and he's hard on young players. But, with young players, they don't really think a lot, or they might do some silly things, and, they kind of get down on themselves. And I always try and say to them, hey, he's yelling at you because he knows you can be better, and you can be better too, and you can, if you think or you do this. And I think that's what I like about playing with him. He's going to yell at you, but he's yelling at you because he knows what you just did wasn't you, or you could be better, or you could have made someone else better. So I think that's important.
I've always said that I play with a lot of hard-ass coaches because they're a lot harder back in my day than they are nowadays. Even Zelko, I was talking to the GM. I was talking to Zoran Savic, who was my teammate here in Madrid. He's like, man, Zelko's just as motivated as ever. I'm like, yeah. I said, but y'all only practice once a day. I'm like, we used to practice three times a day sometimes with Zelko. And he'd be yelling at you all day long. But I think the biggest thing with Zelko, what I've always said was, I played with so many hard-ass coaches before that, just boom, boom, boom. They just want to make you better, make you better, make you better. But they weren't good people, and they weren't fair, you know? And Shelko, I think, what I liked the most about him was as soon as you got outside those four lines, basketball was over for him. He didn't want to talk about it anymore. He was a friend. He was a confidant. He was whoever you wanted him to be. And I think that's a difference, because when you have someone yelling at you that you don't respect, you're not listening as much as you are when you have someone yelling at you that knows going to treat you like a person outside the court. Yeah. That's where I think Zelko wins over a lot of players.
Yeah, yeah, no, 100%. I agree with that fully. Yeah, you feel like, you know, you have that coach that, you know, is scary and you don't want to approach him. But I feel like, you know, I feel like I can approach him. I can, you know, he's not going to be stuck in his ways of do it this way. So, you know, that's important in a coach, and he definitely understands that. Yeah.
Before we get to your favorite part of this interview, give me some of your personal stuff. What are your hobbies? What do you like to do? Like when you were hurt and you wanted to not go to practice for a week or whatever, what would you rather have been doing? What do you like to do outside? Music, golf? A lot of players like golf.
No, I'm a video game guy.
Oh man, I read that, but you're still doing video games.
Not as much now. I'm actually trying to find something that, like, a hobby that I really like. But yeah, no, it's just TV shows, anything to relax and kick the feet up. Because I mean, yeah, you know, those sessions over here in Europe aren't the easiest. So,
you married? Got kids?
No, just a girlfriend at the moment. So
from Australia? From where's she from? The States?
She's from the States. Yeah.
From the States. Okay. Yeah. So she's been traveling around with you. How's that for her? Like enjoying like different lifestyles and being all over the place.
Yeah, no, she's enjoying it. Yeah. Obviously it's an adjustment. She's from Utah. So coming out and seeing the world, it's been good. No, but she's enjoying it. Belgrade's beautiful. You know, I've been being around the waterfront and everything, and you know, it's getting a bit chilly here now, and the fog is starting to set in, but no, I've been enjoying it so far.
What's the best thing that you like about that city? Because, I mean, I love everything about it, just the ambiance, the, like, walking around, like you said, the waterfront where all the restaurants and bars are. Have you found your favorite place yet? I go to this place called The Train, where it's at, the food just keeps on. I don't know if it's called The Train. I think it's called something else. But it's where the food just keeps on coming.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've actually wanted to go to that before, but I haven't. But no, I think the best thing, I mean, it's the little chivapi sausages. those things. I loved them. I had them before when I was in Australia. But yeah, there's something different about the taste when they're over here. So.
Right. The last question, are you still looking back to the NBA? Or are you like trying to like, or is it every day in Europe, is it becoming more and more difficult to look back?
I mean, it's, I think it every time it's going to be, you know, off season weighing up the options. I think because I've been over in Europe, I know what Europe's about. I don't have a problem with playing over here and, you know, and staying over here. But if a good opportunity arises in the NBA where I'm able to play and have a role, I think that's definitely going to be something that I want to do. But yeah, like I love Europe. I love the lifestyle of it, and I think the best thing for me is just, you know, I haven't been able to get out and see the world much, and we had a break and I was able to go to Paris for the weekend, and I was able to walk around in Greece the week before. So I think it's cool just to see the world in that aspect, you know, being from Australia where it's so far from everything and not being able to do that and get on a plane ride for an hour or two and be in, you know, Budapest or Paris or Germany. You know, I think that's an amazing thing.
That's why I came back, man. It's just, there's just so much to do. It's so close. I love it over here. Are you ready, my man? It's EuroLeague test time, brother.
The crossover test.
Ah, yes, here we go. I'm just gonna warn you, I didn't know anything about the EuroLeague growing up.
You know,
so if there's any past questions or even this
we already established from the beginning of this interview that you didn't know anything about EuroLeague or anything growing up, and neither did I. But we tried to format the questions where you might have an idea of what's going on. At least this is going to make you think a little bit. The questions go from 1 to 5, all right? Each one is worth 10 more points. 10 for the first one, 20 for the second one, 30, okay. 40, and 50. Obviously, they get tougher as we go. Let's see, last season's top scorers, all on 100 points, were Nicola Melli, Gershon Yabusele, and Kevin Punter. All right? Your own teammate. So you got to at least beat Kevin, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'll go tell him in practice tonight, too.
There you go.
I have no hope, man. I have no hope. We'll see.
Come on, man. Be confident. Here's your first one. It's worth 10 points. Who were the last final four participants?
Last year? Real Madrid, Barcelona, FS, and Olympiacos.
Look at that. You got 10 points already.
Oh, I probably wouldn't have known that if I wasn't there.
you're on your way. All right, number two. Who's the point index rating, PIR, average leader as of today in the Turkish Airlines EuroLeague?
From Olympiakos, how do you say his last name?
I'm giving it to you. Go ahead, but say it.
No, I don't know how to...
Hey, this is what I go through every day on the commentating the games, man, especially with you Serbian teams with Vucevic and Smiling, yeah. You know? But go ahead, give it a shot.
At least. I knew that question was gonna come up and I was like, I'm gonna mess up his last name too.
What's his first name?
Isn't it Sasha?
There you go, Vizenkov.
Vizenkov, there you go. I was gonna say I don't know.
That's all right. You got it. Look, you got 30 points already.
There you go.
This one's for 30 more points, or 60 if you get it. This ought to be an easy one. Which is the Australian-born player with the most games played in the EuroLeague since the year 2000?
Okay, I think this is going to... See... I might have to go with Dave Anderson.
Bingo.
I got it? Okay. Yeah. I was like, because I was thinking like, I know in my head I want to say Joe Ingles, but like, I don't think, like he wasn't over here like Dave Anderson was.
Yeah, you got it. He played with Cesca, Barca, Fenerbahce, Virtus, Matopesi, 225 total games. I should have let you go there. You might have messed up if I'd have let you go a little bit.
Yeah. All right. I was gonna go with it, Dave Anderson.
All right, 60 points. This is the tie, the three guys from last year. If you make this, this year a most points scored in the first quarter record was achieved in which game?
First quarter.
Most points scored in the first quarter of a EuroLeague game was achieved this year.
I don't know, but I'm just going to say, because we scored 40 against Real Madrid, so I'm just going to say it was us versus Real Madrid, but I don't think that's right. I think there was more.
Look at you, man. You're 4 for 4, man. That's 100 points right off the bat.
I knew because I saw EuroLeague posted saying that, you know, it was like a 40-point quarter. And, so I assumed that was pretty high.
4-32. Y'all were making my job easy, man, commentating that game. That was fun. Man, you might set the record here at 150 points. Question number 5 worth 50 points. No one's ever gotten all 5 of them. Which was the exact score of your last season's playoff game versus Bayern?
The exact score?
Exact score. This isn't like buying a ticket on an airlines where you can like put in like, you know, plus 3 days, minus 3 days, get a better price. I need the exact score for that 50 points.
Do I get a hint at least of can I get the margin?
I'll give you a hint. FC Barcelona won the game.
I want the margin. I want to know how much you won by.
Dude, come on, man. You already got 100 points. You're tied up with the leaders from last year, and you want me to give you hints on top of it?
I'm gonna say something like, I can't remember how much we won by. If I knew how much we won by, I could give you. So I'm gonna go low scoring game, maybe 67-72.
No, wrong, man. Damn, and now if I tell you how much, I'm not going to give you the 50 points, obviously. I got to take those 50 points from you. But if I told you the margin, you're going to remember?
What was the margin?
You won by 9.
No, that wouldn't help me at all. What was it?
81-72.
Okay. Yeah, I knew it was something.
You had the 72, right?
Okay. Yeah, I knew it was 72. I knew it was around there, but I didn't know whether it was down or up. So, okay, yeah.
Yeah, but we don't give half a point, so don't know.
I get 25 for that?
No, you don't get 25. You don't get 25. I'll have three players. I'll have Kevin call me up yelling at me.
I got to go back and look at their questions and see what they had, so.
I think his were tough. I'll have to go back and look. That's a good idea. We're going to have to go back and look at those. Dante, man, I've taken up an hour and a half of your time, man, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule, your busy day, to be here with us here on the crossover. And, man, it's everything I read about you, everything I've heard about you, it's all true. You're just a good, humble kid that you've proved it here in this interview, man, the way you look at things, the way you treat things, the way you treat other people, and I think it's an amazing thing for you. It's a testament of what your parents have done to you, because it's not easy to be as humble as you are and with everything that's going on. So congratulations to you. Good luck this season, and I'll see you around, man. Looking forward to it.
Thank you. Hope to see you in Belgrade.
You're taking me out to dinner, right?
Oh, of course. We'll go to the train.
We'll go to the train. There you go. Thanks, my man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas. If you like what you've heard, subscribe now so you don't miss an episode, and leave us a review on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. You can also get in touch via Twitter and Instagram at EuroLeague using the hashtag ELCrossover, or on Facebook at the EuroLeague.